Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tobin.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like an alligator. And
wow.
To be accurate, I'm actually feeling curious about what it would be like to be an alligator. Because I'm just obsessed. And it's a theme that I've seen over the years, since discovering today's guests' work.
Yes, a recurring theme,
a kind of open-mouthed alligators and teeth.
Yes.
And it got me thinking about the lives of alligators and like how we as humans often are really scared of them. And then maybe that's totally unjustified because they're just living their lives, trying to do their thing. And like, you know, what do alligators do in their time off? Like, you know, if they're not
They eat humans.
No, but they don't.
Eat humans. That's why we're scared of them.
Honestly, I've done loads of research into this and actually very few humans get eaten by alligators. It's actually like often prey that's smaller than humans. It's really fascinating. But I got thinking, like, what does an alligator do in their time off? And like, how do they relax? Like, are they like, do they have a kind of interior world? Like, it really got me thinking. And this is just one of the many things that the work of today's guest has
been thinking about.
Thinking.
Yeah, okay.
I've also been thinking about like, you know, transitional spaces and kind of like ladders and the way that art can help you go from one place to another.
Yes.
In quite a kind of profound way, and how it can actually really improve your kind of experience of the world. So our guest today works across performance and film and sculpture and installation and also painting, and it has become really well known over the past kind of, I'd say, 5-6 years. I was first familiar with the work thanks to Overdune and Kite in Los Angeles. I saw a show there and then saw an amazing solo booth, I think with Tanya Layton maybe, at Freeze New York. And ever since I've been sort of following their work, and I'm just obsessed and I'm really excited. I was texting you before this, like, I'm so excited about tonight's episode, partly because I've never met today's guest and I've never even heard them speak. So I'm really excited. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Math Bass. Hi, Math.
Wow. Hello. Hi. I love that introduction. I can tell you, I know that alligators eat infrequently.
Ah.
So I.
What, humans or anything?
Anything. So they eat and that's it for weeks.
Love that.
Slowly digest their food. So really, I think in their downtime, they're kind of just chilling.
Yeah.
Wow. And the same with crocodiles. They're part of the same sort of pattern of eating.
Yeah.
So and they're, we're talking about that. You know a lot about them then, because they are motif.
Yeah, I know some about like the actual creature, that the animal alligator. I know that out of all of the amphibians, they're the only amphibians that actually care for their young. So they'll, after their eggs hatch, they'll watch over their young. They'll hold their young in their mouths. They use their mouths almost as like a protective cage. And their babies hang out with them for a while until they're big enough to run off and get eaten by, you know, birds.
Wow. And what came first then for you, the alligator as a motif or the interest in alligators?
The alligator as a motif came first, and it happened really spontaneously. I was just in my studio and I was drawing, and this is like, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, I had started to draw a series of discrete symbols, which, you know, in turn grew into a larger vocabulary. One of the first images was an alligator. It wasn't the form that is popular today with my work, but it was a earlier version of it.
Mm. And also your most recent show, which I think is just up now, is it at Veal Meta Projects
in
Los Angeles. That show also has other kind of natural like animals, like snakes. And I saw an amazing image of like a snake wrapped around eggs. And this kind of like, you know, there seems to be an element of kind of like natural history or something as a sort of running theme throughout.
Or archaeology. There's always bones up here.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
This is true. The snake started to pop up in the last 7 months. And I mean, as a symbol or as an animal, when you think about a snake as like such a transformational being.
Yes.
I think, you know, they're... I think that was the genesis of the snake, but I was doing an image search. I was initially searching for images of dragons. I just wanted to see what kinds of images of dragons existed. And then I came upon an image of a snake coiled around its eggs. And there was something about the warmth of the image or the warmth of that, you know, that maternal embrace and protective holding that I found to be really moving. And also just like creatures that are so, so entirely alien from us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so this, like you show that Rob was talking about, this is a transition for you in the fact that you've discovered oil paint. But let's go back to the original, what we was talking about, this kind of vocabulary, this language you've built of symbols, which feels like it's, I think at one point you've called it cave art after Adobe. It feels like for the emoji generation.
So good.
These kind of,
oh my God.
These symbols appear in your work since 2012 when you developed an ongoing series called News, which is spelt with a Z on the end instead of an S. And through them is how I discovered your work, and mainly at the MoMA PS1 show, which was in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
And you create these, they're unprimed canvas, and you create these simplified, formal, solid colors, but they're hard-edged geometric shapes, but they're also this vocabulary you're saying you've kind of amassed over the years, but they're loaded. These symbols seem to be loaded in something, and they all formally are created on these canvases. Let's talk about these, because this is an ongoing series for you and something that you're constantly exploring.
Yeah, and I think what has kept me really interested in this vocabulary and in the use and repetition of a fairly, you know, pared down set of symbols has been almost like an investigation into like a tonal language, almost like in the sense of like musical notation that we have this composition where it's like you can say like stop, or you can say like stop. You know, there's so many different tonal varieties and relationships that I'm finding emerge between these images, which are like, some of them are directly referencing things that already exist, and others are kind of dealing with the kind of interplay between the body and architecture, between what is familiar and what is more obtuse or more abstract. And I think kind of interested in that space in between the what's known and what's unknown, the abstract and the familiar, and kind of thinking about, there's something I think I find about the language to be very familiar for people that allows them to enter it. But then once you're standing inside of it, you're like, wait, I don't actually, what is this language? And I don't know what this is exactly. But I think I invite for an openness of the experience.
Yeah, you like people to decipher the language, and you like people to get lost in that. I always feel like these symbols, more and more appear every year. It feels like there's a new addition to the vocabulary. And for me, I always feel like, well, I've always wanted to ask you, are these symbols autobiographical and the recurring motif of them? Is each symbol loaded? Because I always feel like there's some tension between the symbols and the way that you position them together. But it feels like each symbol is kind of a moment in your life, potentially. Is that a right way to decipher that?
They enter at different moments in my life, but they're not in and of themselves describing the moment. But there's always an interesting sort of like when I look over the last 8 years when different symbols have emerged and I can identify these, poignant.
Can you say any stories behind, like, because the bone appears, or the cigarette and the matches? It always makes me think of Grease the musical whenever I feel that, because I feel like it's a very kind of macho, in some ways, quite smoking cigarettes, and it's a bit naughty and a bit, and it feels like it's of a time as well, like the 60s. Mm. It feels that vibe in your kind of practice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do love just like the ephemerality of the cigarette. I love the way, like, I don't smoke anymore. I used to smoke, and it's one of those things that eventually I just had to stop doing. Like, I couldn't just keep smoking into my 40s and 50s. But I loved just like the framing of the moment, or the way that the cigarette really like gave you this pause and like just expanded, and like kind of the like alchemy of like burning and inhaling and exhaling and feeling the breath in that way, and like the weight of something kind of like turning from material into the immaterial. And I think when I actually started painting the cigarettes, I literally had stopped smoking.
So you were sort of wanting a cigarette. So instead of one cigarette, you painted one.
Yeah, basically.
I've always been really interested in your practice about how you're able to sort of create sculptures and environments that you can walk through. So, for example, if you think about your MoMA PS1 installation, for example, you had like the ladder like leaning against the wall, and then you had like floor sculptures, and then you even like opened up a wall in between two different spaces. And then when you look at them in relation to the other works you make, such as your films or even your performances or the paintings that Russell's been describing, like there's such an interesting connection between all of them. And it's almost like sometimes the objects that are leaning on the walls have just jumped off a painting, or vice versa. And that even like your early film, I think maybe from like 2011 or 2013, something like that, where you have the, I think you're actually inside like almost like tents. You know, like those shapes of those tents, almost like circus tents or something, they could also, again, be like objects in the paintings. So it's this very cohesive universe that you've created. How easy is that for you as an artist to do? Is it like a real difficult thing to pull off? Because it seems really complex.
I try not to do anything that's too difficult. No, I'm just kidding. It's something that kind of just comes natural. I mean, okay, so when I started working with those tented forms, I was on Los Feliz Boulevard, which is like a prominent boulevard in Los Angeles that it's like, you know, there's a span of mansions, like literally on a thoroughfare. And I'm like, why would you ever want to your mansion to be on a thoroughfare? Like, isn't the point that your mansion is somewhat insulated? But there's, you know, a series of huge estates on like basically what is kind of like a highway. And one day I was walking down the street and there was a mansion that was tented for termite. So when the termite tent goes up, it's literally like this spectacle of condemnation. It's like striped, broad stripes, orange and yellow and these colors. And it's literally, I was like, wow, that what a spectacle. And also how this like mansion has suddenly become a break in the landscape, a hole in those like kind of repetitive shades of beige and gray and pale pink and white. And I was really struck by it. And I was like, what would happen like if I tented a body? What would happen? How would the body turn into a location? So in a way, it's like a lot of my work really comes from my encounters with the everyday. Mm-hmm. And then in how I take those really kind of regular encounters, but then I synthesize them or organize them into my mind in a new form.
Yeah.
So a lot of it just has to do with like, I don't know, like, you know, sometimes I'm just like really vibing with like the rhythm of everything. And I'm like, the car intersects the tree while the jogger runs by and it hits the beat of my song that I'm listening to. And I'm like, you know, so oftentimes I'm really like generating a lot of ideas from sort of just being in the world.
From existing, yeah.
So these houses, that isn't a thing that we're used to here. So that's like chemical bombing, is it, inside?
It's chemical bombing. Yeah, and in Los Angeles, it's like it's a common thing. It's like usually before someone sells a house, they tent it for termites and you see the tent go up, and it's only up for like 3 days.
And why is that? Why do they choose these incredibly vibrant?
I wonder if it's because it's so toxic that they're just kind of like, do not go near this house.
Or do not enter.
Like a wasp, like a bee.
Or maybe it could have even been like an advertisement by one company back in the day. Like, wow, wouldn't it be funny if instead of just putting a gray tarp over this house, we made a tent like a circus tent. I think it's just something that caught trend, but it is spectacular. And when it does happen here, I get very excited about it. I just find it.
I think it's incredible because you've taken, as Rob was saying, these tarps and then they've been laid over kind of structures. And in your work, the body is present or it is absent. But it always feels like the body is an element, whether it be your body or one's body to project in. But these forms kind of create like, I always feel like they're either like a den you go and play in as a kid, or it's like there's a human figure underneath that's been shrouded and they're doing something. They're either in like quite a sexual position, some of them potentially, or just being present. Like they're being hidden. It's being revealed. Where are you, by the way? You're in the middle of a raid.
You're on the mansion thing.
It's so loud. I know.
A bit of a termite bombing. Yeah.
Ambulances and cop cars, and I'm on Los Feliz Boulevard.
Love it. Oh, busy morning there. So much.
I'm in a high rise on Los Feliz Boulevard.
Right.
The high Los Angeles high rise.
Wow. Genius. Well, we can hear it.
Yeah. I moved into this like funky mid-century high rise. It's kind of borders on being in a retirement home. And I love it.
That's great. That's great. So anyway, these structures then that we were talking about. So they for you simulate a body being present or absent.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like that non-duality of having both at once is what I'm really interested in. And those tarps were initially, basically they were performance costumes for a two-channel video that I made when I was doing my thesis at UCLA, and then they moved on to have lives as sculptural form. So it is a lot oftentimes about kind of like how something can go from being a costume, a prop, to being a form, to then being like refed back into potentially like a two-dimensional frame, being spit back out into a three-dimensional form, and kind of trying to find almost like this line between like an inherent flatness that becomes voluminous. And I always find that to be like really compelling. It's like there was a series of metal forms that were almost like a flattened and then like reconstituted silhouette of some of the vocabulary. And those were positioned in space at Overton & Co. In a sense, it was like a viewer kind of couldn't look at any painting without looking through a sculpture. And depending on where you were standing in the room, the sculptures either became like razor thin or became incredibly full. I'm interested in like kind of like the invitation, like the way that someone who's viewing the work can move through the space and move through the sculpture in a way I'm hoping kind of facilitate this like bodily relationship between form and then two-dimensional image.
So it's almost performative as well in some ways then. You're embracing that side of an audience.
Yeah, it's like the sculptures can be performed by and then also informed by the movement of the viewer.
Right.
And what you're saying about recurring, like bringing that in from an earlier work, it feels like you bring these works in from all through your career and through your practice, and yet there doesn't seem to be any hierarchy for moments in it. You bring them all into the present day. A lot of these works are from, like there was concrete sculptures at MoMA PS1 that were from 2012, and then there was works 2015, and as you go forwards, again, you borrow from the new series, which is ongoing. So it always feels like there's a constant thread with you where you haven't decided on what is finite in a body of work.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's always sort of this circularity to it in a way where I can return back to something that, you know, that I found or like came upon like 7 years ago, and to kind of bring that into the present moment, to bring that freshness to it to me. Like, it's not about like, okay, well, I did that. It's done. Goodbye. I'm never going to make a cast of denim shorts again. Because I think when I look at the entire body of work, I think it is this ongoing cast of character, and that, you know, there's a lot of space for those characters to kind of step forward, emerge, recede, come back again, you know, take their leave. So in a way there's like, I think of it as like this theater of images.
Yeah.
I think I've always imagined that somehow there's like a dictionary or like some kind of like tome or something that has this kind of civilization, like a record of a civilization that's somehow being revealed slowly through your work. It's like a really strange subconscious thing that I pick up, but I've never really had to understand it fully because I trust in just how I'm feeling when I look at the work. You know what I mean? Like it's, and I quite like that kind of openness. It doesn't feel strict or anything. It's like,
it's not, and there's not any way that it's not that there's a certain, I'm not aiming towards having people, like I'm not trying to control one's experience of view or one's experience of relating with the work. And there is an intended openness. And that comes from a general, my experience of openness, just like in the way that I move through the world and approach relationships and engage with images and artifact. And I mean, I was watching this incredible, really great, I think it was even like a documentary about the 18th dynasty in Egypt and kind of like about the scribers and how if you wanted to like basically enunciate an idea, it was like the symbol was just repeated. Like, so there'd be like 10 images of Osiris's profile repeated just to like be like stretch it out. And I was vibing.
So now we would use an exclamation mark over and over again. That would be the emoji generation's way of doing it. That's how we'd process that information now. But then,
kind of
wow,
makes me think of Nancy Spiro as well, weirdly. Like, you know, when Nancy Spiro used to like repeat like objects within the wall, murals or paintings or what have you. I love Nancy's work, God.
So and weird. I mean, I think there is like that repetition and that what we find through like slow change through repetition, abrupt shifts, seeing something kind of repeat in fragment, repeat in full form. And then also the way that repetition can give birth to entirely new symbols or like to recombine one image with one symbol with another. And then we find like an entirely new, like a lot of the vocabulary grew and was generated by sometimes even just pulling out a fragment of one symbol. It's like, where did the bee come from? Well, it was the top of something else. Like, and then where did the flower come from? Well, it was like multiplying what was sort of like this ball socket image into parts. Like it was just, so a lot of it is like kind of like, how do you take like four words and create an entire novel out of them or something? Yeah. And how do you kind of work with these limitations to,
I feel like there's, because we was talking about Greece and the smoking and everything, the way that I kind of projected onto it, but there is a gender kind of vibe that goes through all the symbols you've chosen as well. So like you just mentioned the flower, which would, you know, stereotypically gendered be for the female, you know.
And it's kind of a mask flower.
Yeah.
It's a very mask flower.
It's not a binary flower. That flower is, you know, for everyone.
But we do have the hard static flower and we have the more liquidy fluid flower. You know,
yes.
There's like these different... But there was something, okay, so in this documentary last night, something that really struck me was speaking about all of the images that were depicting the afterlife were completely frozen. You never see a depiction of movement because once you start to move, the image becomes finite. But when it's presented as frozen, the stasis kind of is a kind of an indicator of the infinite or the infinite potential. Mm. And I thought that was so interesting. I mean, even just in thinking about my own kind of examinations into these like frozen yet animated. Yeah.
But would you animate them now, having that conversation now? See,
like in an actual film?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
like
so
if they
funny
weren't spinning, moving.
I have friends who are animators who are like, give me your vocabulary. I want to make, please. And I'm like, I mean, I haven't done it yet, you know? I've thought about it, of course, but at the moment, I think there's something that already is, like that the tension between stasis and movement is so built into them that,
You know, I could see Super Mario just going up and down. You know, all the jaws of the crocodile,
such a,
alligators.
That's our,
and, yeah,
our 4-bit generation. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I actually find those flower works really arresting, like. Looking at an image of a flower is something so expected that you think you know what your relationship is to it. You think you know you understand it, even because you see flowers in the real world. But your flowers are actually quite strange. Like they're quite compelling. And like you're talking about having different variations of the same flower in a way that some of them maybe are almost melting or, you know, morphing, or they're very other to me, those flowers. And I think the first time I saw them, I was like, maths doing flowers? Like in the work? Like, what is this? But then the more I looked at them, I was like, these are totally compelling. Like, they really, really are strong. Was it quite a surprise to you when you started to, you know, make these images of flowers?
I think one of the last flower paintings that really surprised me was in the last solo show that I did with Tanya Leighton in Berlin. And it was basically like, to me, very much these flowers were bodies in a way. Like, I felt like they were very bodily. And then there was a small silhouette of a stealth bomber that was kind of just tucked into the composition. Wow. And it was clearly like, oh, these two things kind of don't exactly go together, but then there was this way that, I don't know, I was interested in the way that they just kind of slipped in there.
But I mean, that to me makes me feel of like Vietnam War, or make peace, not war, and Yoko and John and the flower, and the that kind of a very Americana 60s feel that I feel your work has, the kind of nostalgia to it.
Yeah,
it really excites me. But as you're saying, it has this ambiguity as well for an audience to decipher. But there's like, you have these speech bubbles that feature a lot. Sometimes the bone can look like a speech bubble, or sometimes there is a speech bubble. Mm. But most of the time, they're empty. And I think someone's described them as hovering between the speech bubble and unspeakable. And there's something that you're wanting to say, but you don't have the words for it. So these symbols take that place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always found, I haven't always had the most easy relationship with just speaking. I admire and I'm in awe of people who can just orate freely. And for me, it's never been so easy. But I remember that quote. I think Connie Butler said that, and I thought it was like a really beautiful way of talking about that kind of utterance, or that like between the speakable and the unspeakable. And I mean, I think, you know, I like the way that those speech bubbles kind of like hover on whether like something is being spoken or something is being ingested. The speech bubble originally was a fragment from a bone, and that's where it was pulled from.
Yes.
Ah, right.
Right, the end, isn't it? Yeah.
So I wasn't seeking out, like, I want to make a speech bubble, but it was something that I found in a fragment in another work, in a composition.
Yeah. Well, it feels like you're painting sound, and that sort of kind of solid, like, harnessing sound. But if, as a performance artist, that's where you started, and I saw a performance of yours called Brutal Set, where you're singing, and it starts off very harmonious, then it's incredibly discordant and hard to listen to, and it ends with you smashing a plant pot on the floor after climbing
to like
ladder.
stop
and then it comes in with
beautiful song. It comes in with the gorgeous pop song, you know.
Yes, yeah, one is the loneliest number, and it's really powerful. But your voice is incredible, stunning, but it feels like that even though I don't know if you're still performing like that anymore, which I can't find anything recently, but it feels like that is being pushed into the flatness of the paintings. You're kind of harnessing sound.
I do. I love working with sound. I love sound as material, even just combining sound and editing sound.
Right.
And even working with video, like for me, there isn't like a separation between those two things. Like if I'm, you know, editing video or and working with sound, there's always just like finding those rhythms and repetitions. And when it comes to like singing, for me, like that's my most comfortable way of like speech in a way, or like working with kind of like I'll get these hits of sentences, like I'll be like, you know, driving, and suddenly it's like an entire sentence pops into my head, and I'm like, I don't know where this came from, but I'll write it down, and then I'll later just sort of draw it out, or find the tone, or find a way of kind of like bellowing it And in a sense, it's like you take this language and you bring it into song, and it's like you're physicalizing all of this feeling. And to do that with a group of people, for me, is just like, I don't know, it's just really powerful.
When was the last time you did that? Was it in 2012?
I've done smaller performances, like the closing of shows, but I haven't done I did a performance at the Whitney about 3 years ago, and there was a lot of singing in that performance.
And did you sing in that?
I sang in that with a few other people.
And have you recorded your voice?
Only, like, you know, on my computer, on my phone. I had in the show that I did with Mary Boone, I had a series of recordings that I made with a couple of my friends. So there were these tall ply columns with black holes, and the sound was coming out of those holes. So there were four of them, and the sound was kind of broken apart so that you could sort of stand in between these columns, these sound sculptures, and you could sort of hear someone with a soprano and my bass voice across the room. So you're kind of getting hit by these vibrational frequencies.
Wow. So you're a sound artist, yeah.
I really love sound. I mean, I find that there's something that I can achieve. There's something that I can do with sound that I can't do with painting per se. And there's something I can do with painting that I can't do with sound. And I kind of just dip back into that continually. But I've never played an instrument. Like, when I was growing up, you had to take one instrument from, like, say, fourth grade through sixth, and then you could stop. So I was literally screeching at the violin and, like, pretending to play it. Like, I was like, I don't. And then I didn't have to do it ever again. And I wish in a way that I had been able to continue to develop that relationship, because I think I have a musical mind. I have a rhythmic way of writing. I have a rhythmic way of producing images. So I think whatever might, like, feed into, like, one's ability to play an instrument, it's kind of just gotten, like, rerouted for me.
Mm. You know, earlier on we were talking about that film you made, Past the Line, with the mm-hmm. with the kind of tent shapes. I heard that the kind of thing that sparked off that film was actually linked to your anxiety to do with your performances. I read this really interesting interview with Mia Lox, the curator, and you from a while back, I think. And you were talking about this anxiety, and I read it and it resonated so strongly with me, because it brought back all the memories from being on stage myself when, you know, you're kind of being given the privilege of actually, you know, being able to perform and do these things in the world. And then suddenly the anxiety kicks in. And, you know, I heard Sia the other day talking on a podcast, the singer-songwriter, and she was saying that when she worked with Christina Aguilera, for example, Christina was like, I live for performance. You know, and every day I wake up and I want to perform. And the only time I'm happy is when I'm on stage. And Sia was like, for her, it was like the polar opposite. And for me, it's the polar opposite, like getting on stage.
Polar opposite.
Yeah, and it's the same for you.
I mean, even right now, I'm experiencing a great deal of anxiety because I get so anxious. I don't know how people do it. Like, so when I was in my early 20s, I think I was such an exhibitionist. I was like in the, you know, underground art scene in Chicago, and we were all just like out there performing, doing like wild stuff. And it was like, but then as I got older, it got harder and harder, to the point where I was like, okay, I can maybe do this once a year, to like, okay, maybe I can't do this at all. Like, I don't even know. It's just, it is incredibly vulnerable.
Yes.
And I do know that when I move past that extreme, I mean, it's the kind of anxiety where, like, I watched this YSL documentary and I was like, oh, poor baby. I can see how anxious he is.
Yeah.
Just having to, like, go and, like, stand in front of his collection. He's just, like, collapsing with anxiety. And I know what that feels like, but I also know what happens when you actually get on and it switches. And then somehow that tension transitions into just this utmost present feeling where whatever that presence is, like, creates an entire, like, kind of opening around you. And I think that that is the generous offering for me of performance, is opening up that space and inviting the people who are in the room as participants, because we're all participating in kind of resurrecting this super present event.
It's kind of a privilege, isn't it? It feels like a privilege for everyone suddenly.
I think there's something spiritual about it. I think there's something that cannot possibly be recorded. So, like, I found when I look at the actual documentation of every single performance, I'm like, I can't even, because I know what was happening IRL, and it just doesn't translate.
Right.
I think, I'm not saying it's an impossible thing, but for me, it hasn't.
I think it's the fragility, you know. There's something so fragile about a live performance, you know, that at any moment something could even go wrong. Like maybe your voice when you start singing doesn't work anymore. That used to be my fear. Or, you know, and I remember losing my voice off stage and then going on stage and being able to sing. It was like the weirdest thing. Mm. So like, you know, just this kind of level of fragility and tenderness and like vulnerability, like you were saying. I think, and I was thinking a lot about, we interviewed Laurie Anderson recently, and I heard that you did a performance using a helmet and a scooter. And I love this idea because she's been doing work with people's cars recently, like an orchestra of people's motor cars, like as one of her recent works. It's so genius. And also there's an artist from Norway called Tori Rones, who I know is a big fan of yours. And
I don't know if you have met each other.
Yes.
I've been to one of Tori's performances that Tori did in LA,
yes,
in like the bowels of a parking structure.
That's right, yeah.
And it was incredible. Yeah. That really blew me away. Like Tori had, I don't know, somehow like gathered together a bunch of bodybuilders that she like solicited at the gym to participate. So there were these like muscle-bound bodybuilders pulling.
Why have I not seen this? This is right up my screen.
I'll send you the book, Russ. The book's amazing. Yeah, okay. So
bodybuilders pulling other people on dollies, and then there were people on bicycles, and then the sort of cacophony of human voices echoing in a parking structure that was probably like six levels down, which, as you know, is like kind of a terrifying feeling. Mm. Like in the subterranean basement of earthquake country. Whenever I drive into my parking spot, I almost don't even park in my parking spot anymore because I drive all the way down. And I'm like, fuck.
just to go back onto anxiety, sorry to do that, but there was a time when you were given the opportunity for a show, which I think was probably put you really on the map, which was at MoMA PS1 in 2015. You was given a solo show there called, which you named Off the Clock. But prior to that, you had a bit of a panic meltdown and took yourself off somewhere to Joshua Tree in the desert with your dog to have some time alone to reassess. But while you were there, the word babbo appeared to you. Really strongly. And there's a restaurant in New York near Washington Square Park called Babbo, which I passed a lot when I've been there. And I always think of you. And I'm always like, is it related to that? But this word came out of nowhere. But that you channeling that panic into this show. Can we talk about what that sort of pressure was on you and how that all came about? And
I was in New York. I was installing a three-person show at Henry Street at Henry Gallery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was a little show, tiny. And at that time, Henry was in a tiny, tiny little space. And I had known Mia. I had met Mia a few times. Mia was at USC curatorial when I was at UCLA for grad. And Mia had also gone to school with my, at the time, partner. And I just got a call while it was the winter. I think we were all like picking up lumber from some lumber yard in New York, which even like kind of amassing materials in New York is such a different experience than being in LA. Cause in LA you go to the lumber yard. In New York, it's like, I'm carrying 2x4s through like Chinatown. Like so I remember sludging through the show with 2x4s and then getting a call inviting me to have a solo show at PS1.
Whoa.
And I was like, of course. And then it was like, and it's going to be in 4 months. And I was like, okay. And then I think the idea was like, Mia was just really interested in bringing together the works, the more ephemeral works, the sculptural based works, the props from performances, and the current body of work, and sort of just bringing them all into this moment. And it was kind of like a mad dash, like, how is this going to work? And then And it did work. But I remember when I went to visit the site, they were like, these are the rooms. And there were literally four separate project rooms that are not it. I mean, I was like, how, what? Like, so I was like, I need to open these walls up. I can't do this. And then at the time, my date had made this really incredible sculpture that was kind of framing out this architectural anomaly at my studio. It was this under the stairs form, sort of like a rectangle. What is the name of the shape where it goes into a rectangle, into a point, and then whatever. So they had framed out this
rhombus.
Let's call it a trapezoidal rhombus. So
that sounds cute.
So we are so scientific. I love the three of us.
A trapezoidal rhombus, yeah. Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
This trapezoidal rhombus form.
Yeah, I love it.
Ended up kind of like, you know, moving from my studio to PS1. So I was interested in like kind of transposing one space on another. Mm-hmm. Then it also created this like moment of repeat or almost like glitching, because in one room it was flush against the wall and bordered on pointing at it being like kind of a reveal of the interior structure of the wall, though the material was too slight to actually be structural. And then two rooms over, it repeats, but it's kind of shifting so that one could potentially pass through. And then also I think that it's not something I could totally explain, but it felt like the show kind of shifted in manner. It kind of just took a turn. It became a little like less frozen.
What was that like to be given a show at MoMA, to kind of go straight to the top and the pressure of that? And you were really exposed. You were, everybody was talking about the world. What was that like, and how did you cope with that?
I didn't really understand what it was at the time. I know that sounds, but I didn't totally understand what it meant or what it was. And I think it brought a lot of attention, and in a way it was almost like too much. Mm. It was like, okay, back off. And I couldn't, I kind of stepped back from it a little bit. I found it to be overwhelming a little bit. I also don't think I totally understood the magnitude of having a solo show at that institution. Mm. And partly maybe that's because I like live in my own like weird math world, but I'm like, great, PS1, cool, amazing. But I didn't,
What do you mean a math world?
Just like in my like.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the subject, the school subject. I'm like, oh, no. like Sudoku like my... and stuff. Oh, no, like that's your name, Sudoku. Isn't it? Yes, got it.
I think I was like great, but it didn't register. It wasn't like, and now I'm on the red carpet or something. Like it just didn't.
So would you do it differently if that came up now? If you hadn't had that experience then, and now you're in a position, would there be different things you would do?
Well, I think, God, I don't even know. I mean, I would probably want to like, I think I would want to like kind of have a little bit more time. Yeah. I think I'd want like, you know, a couple years. Mm-hmm. And I think I would want to sort of like not start from zero, but I think I would want to like conceive the entire show like from this point until completion. What else? Maybe, I mean, I was also young. I was young. I was, for me, I mean, I wasn't that young, but I mean, I've always felt.
We're the same age, me and you. We're both not.
I know, you're an 81er.
Yes. Hello.
Right, I really
both
like
me
people.
Feel really old.
Good.
I really, I have this. You're 1980. That's, oh God. I have an affinity so with the 80. I love that. I actually started like a band with my friends in LA right before COVID really like hit. It was like pre-COVID, and it was called 81. Because everyone in the band was born in 81. And we had like two sessions. We recorded them like on our iPhones. And I was like, I was like, this is too good to be true. 81 just peaked. Like it was just like so cool. And like
it's the best year to ever be born.
Yeah. 81. I also had an
affinity. Ruff could be your backup singer.
Did you have friends from 79? I don't know why. There was something about 79ers. I just like
my brother's 79.
I loved the goddamn 79ers. I'm not saying I don't love the 80s, the 85s, but there was. I'm just thinking specifically about being in high school, when if someone's 2 years older, they seem like an adult. But all of my friends were 79.
Yeah. Damn, there's something kind of pathetic. There's something kind of pathetic about 1980, isn't there? But 79, 81 feel really
81.
Cute. You're a bully, Russell.
But you were born. I googled you. You were born November. I was born September 17th. So isn't that funny?
Wow. And I'm in October, so we can like celebrate every month of autumn. Wonderful.
We've got Virgos, we've got Libras, we've got Scorpios. We're going through the.
I love it. You know, something I've noticed, Math, is that the response to your work critically is very kind of poetic and entertaining and fun in a way. Like a lot of the reviews I've read, people get really like animated and quite flowery.
People get saucy. Language.
Yeah, they get
that's
they get
good.
Saucy. I know, but I actually think that's quite unique to you. I think you bring out something. Like there's an amazing article in Freeze written by Dan Fox. I love that.
Oh, yeah.
All about puns and like props. And,
I know.
But it's a really poetic, it's a great piece of writing. Like, he's brilliant anyway, but like, I just thought it's really fascinating that your work, are you aware that you have that kind of impact or capability of getting things out of people?
I never thought of it before. My friend William just wrote an article that was in Artillery that I thought was so beautiful and also incredibly poetic. And it's almost like it is about my work, but then he also just runs with it and like makes a whole.
Yeah.
I can send you a link to that, but I mean, that feels, I would love for that. I mean, I think that ultimately that's what I would aspire towards, is kind of sharing that exchange of openness and having people feel like they can kind of break out of what might be expected.
Yeah, totally.
As like some kind of critical text or review or, yeah.
It's like, fun, and there's a lot of humor in there, but it's also very camp at times. I'm thinking of The Leg in particular, that's kind of like Bob Fosse's cabaret leg sort of comes in from the corner of the canvas and sort of come down, or like figure skating. It's not figure skating. What do you call the thing in the swimming pools where everyone's legs
synchronized?
Synchronized swimming. Yeah. That's what it makes me think of. And that, I mean, that is so enticing, but that again is a new motif that sort of came in during the Bloomby show, which I love, which I actually got a work from, which is when I first collected you. But that was amazing. But are you two questions here? Bloomingdale's, what is the obsession with Bloomingdale's? And secondly, the leg motif, what does that symbolize for you?
The leg motif, I mean, it originated from another kind of casual studio drawing. It was this like form that I was just making some little drawings with ink and like brush and ink drawings. And it was this like kind of almost like felt like this torso with like a bottom of sorts and then a leg that came out. And then I was like, oh, I really like that leg. So I just continued to work with it and draw it and refine it until it became like a really graphic, streamlined image. And then for the Bloomingdale show, I moved into a new studio right when I started making that show. The studio coincidentally was very long and narrow. Uh-huh. And I ordered a series of canvases that when they showed up, I had an image, I had an idea for a composition that I realized wasn't going to work. But when the canvases actually arrived, they were so long and narrow. And I was like, what am I going do with this? Like, this is it's too narrow, it's too long. And I kind of like laid down on the floor in my studio, which I often do if I'm trying to figure something out. I find like, get horizontal, close your eyes, close my eyes, and it was literally like Bloomingdale's. It was like, but then so I went with it. And then I started to like kind of, you know, searched for a like high res Bloomingdale's, you know, logo. But, and then I juxtaposed that or incorporated like my symbol with this pre-existing logo so that they're kind of like underscoring, semi-obscuring, merging. It's such a recognizable icon that even if it's like somewhat obscured, you know what it is.
Yeah.
And it also was such a thing at one point. Like it was like this, like it was really like a place to be seen and like to see and be seen. And now since is just really like a kind of a shell of what it was. Like, growing up, my mom would always be like, do you want to go to Bloomingdale's? And we would go to Bloomingdale's. And it was just, it's...
Well, there was some lyrics that were on one of the press sheets of yours that it was about Bloomingdale's, about the show, which was in 2016 at Michael John Nallen Gallery in Miami. And it said, there is a place on the east side of town. They know my face because I'm always around. A pillar of strength, a haven to turn to, the place where I learn to feel noble and proud. Yes, it's Bloomingdale's. In a class beyond compare, the other stores all pale. Everything your heart desires will one day be on sale at Bloomingdale's. And that was written by David Sonnenberg in 1975, and it became a song that was recorded in 2016. Mm-hmm. That's powerful stuff.
I it's funny because I love David Sonnenberg. He's just an incredible person, and I'm really close with him and his wife and his kids. One of my closest friends, Elizabeth, is his daughter. And I was hanging out with his wife, Shelley, and I showed her my Bloomingdale's painting, and she was like, wait, have you ever heard David sing the Bloomingdale song? And I was like, no, what Bloomingdale song? She was like, okay, hold on. David wrote, and she told me the whole story. David just wrote a song about Bloomingdale's that never got recorded. It was like in his jingle box. Never got recorded. It's just an incredible song because it's like, it's so not about Bloomingdale's. Like it's actually when you like listen to the lyrics and hear the song, like there's really nothing actually about Bloomingdale's in the song, and I like love how much of a projection it is. Like,
yeah,
and it's just a beautiful
it's the
storm
interior,
song.
Isn't it, someone, yeah.
So David and Elizabeth, who is just an incredible singer and who I've collaborated with on song and on music before, because she's really talented. One of those people who can just ad lib, completely improvise a fully constructed song. Like it's an incredible gift. So she and David recorded themselves singing a duet, and I think I had like 5 takes of it that played intermittently throughout the show. So that like was this like feeling of being in the exhibition space and being in a showroom and being in a domestic space, and that show is kind of touching on all of these different spaces with this soaring soundtrack about Bloomingdale's, which I thought also just brought more humor to it, because it is a funny body of work.
Yes, it is, totally. But and now we're in a shift, as we touched on earlier on, at Ville Meta space. You've now moved, you've worked for years on the new series, the paintings from 2012, which are flat and they're on gouache on unprimed canvas. And now you've moved into oil paint. So this new body of work is completely made with oil paint. But what's really interesting to me is that now the presence of paint is very clear. It's very painterly. It's very shaded. It's very, there's more realness to it rather than geometric abstraction, hard lines. It feels like there's a softness to this now. Mm. As you sound about, and we touched on the snakes that were surrounding the eggs. There's like an element of that which is very, very fleshy suddenly, rather than just a flat one color. There's a lot of density to it. Is this for this body of work, or is this a new like shift for you going into oil paint and embracing that more?
I think I'm going to continue working with oil. I was trying to identify, okay, where did this shift actually come from?
Mm.
And I think in some way it has to be a response to the restrictions of this pandemic. Because when I think about the former bodies of work being like such internal language, so much of it was kind of this deep, like auto-generated set of images with my own kind of idiosyncratic meaning. Mm-hmm. To then kind of go and have like the structure of our society become so restrictive and shut down. I think that I kind of got to this place where making work that was so unforgiving, because with the gouache and the canvas, it's like there's just no room for error. And I think I couldn't possibly, on top of really not being able to do anything or go anywhere, also just have a completely unforgiving, you know, method of image making. And I also kind of think I started to like externalize a little bit more, even like externalize my emotional state, start to look outward towards images that I find to be like really poignant and relatable to this moment. And I was kind of like, right now I'm just kind of like interested in the way that the vocabulary I've amassed can engage with new forms, but also in just opening up the possibility to potentially paint anything. And the oil is just so, it has its own intelligence. It's really challenging. I found myself coming up against my own just like wall. I mean, it was just sometimes absolutely just humiliating to try, as an adult, to try to do something that you don't know how to do after having done something that kind of nailed down for so long.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Do you normally paint freehand, this archive of signs that you work through? Are they freehand, or do you work with stencils, or how do you, because they're always so perfect.
No stencils. I compose images digitally, so I know what the image is going to be with the gouache paintings. And then I transfer them onto the canvas. And then it's a very painstaking process of basically like creating I use a little beveled tool, which is like a barbecue skewer, cut at a beveled angle to create the outer edge. And then I go on and paint with brush. So nothing is taped unless it's a gradient, because it's impossible to make a gradient without taping.
Mm.
But but no stencils. Yeah, no stencils. Because everything is the size of each form is so specific to the composition that it really is about like finding that tension. So that if it was just kind of like plop, 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 it would
work. It wouldn't be as dynamic, would it? It wouldn't have the tension between the...
No, because sometimes it's literally just adjusting something by like a hair and it's like, ah,
right,
there it is.
And it's right. You know, the last few weeks I've been thinking a lot about Los Angeles and how much I miss it, but also with the death of Sophie, the music producer who was a big hero of mine, it really brought up Los Angeles because a lot of my friends from there were reaching out and either lived with or knew Sophie. And it was, you know, rest in peace to Sophie and thank you so much for everything they did because extraordinary contribution to culture and music and art as well. Mm. But it got me thinking, what is it like as an artist to like live in LA? Because I think it's such a unique community and it's, is it something that's enriching for you? Do you, who do you hang out with? Like what's important about LA for you and your work?
And I also would like to say, like, rest in peace, Sophie. I've got a lot of close friends who were really, close with Sophie, feeling the weight of that loss. I have lived here for going on 16 years, which is almost as long as I've lived anywhere, because I left New York when I was 17, and I never returned. As a city, I mean, it's funny asking me this question because I was kind of thinking about it this morning because it has changed, which cities always do. When I first moved here, it was like very strange, like nothing was what it appeared to be. It was like this strip mall was actually like the best club. Like you could go into like this blacked out storefront. It was like, what is this? So it was always like these little treasures being revealed and you kind of just had to like, you know, you were like kind of like ushered in to like a really like secret underground scene, which has since become much more visible. I think there's a spaciousness to it and like a kind of unfolding, scrolling, like feeling. It's almost like I think of like a reel of film, just like rolling and rolling. And so much of space is experienced like in a moving vehicle. Mm-hmm. And it's like you just get glimpses. Like if you ever actually walk from like one end of Sunset Strip all the way to like Chinatown, it's amazing because you're like, oh, this is a real city. I'm just like kind of seeing it unfold in a different like scale, a different timeline. And I love doing that actually. There's like a really long night walk because during the day you can't. Not only because it's just like the brutal sun, but also it's too like you're too exposed and raw, but there's something about nighttime in LA that I find particularly like dreamy to just walk for a really long time. I have really, you know, gorgeous friendships here that I don't know what I would do without my community of people, mostly artists, somewhat intergenerational, queer. The last year, I mean, it's definitely spooky here. I mean, there's just so many structures that are boarded up that will never open. And I'm like, what will become of this Denny's? What will become, like, there's just the whole ghost, like the movie theater is like shuttered. Just like it's taken on like a really dire tone. Mm. Kind of like the collapse is alive and well in Los Angeles. Mm.
Mm. Well, you touched on the queer community there, which feels really important in your practice, and queerness and otherness feel like they're fundamental to the meaning of a lot of your work. Do you feel like that's something you could talk about?
Yeah, I think about, you know, being trans and not and having like kind of a gender that is indeterminate in a way, or is you know, somewhat both and none, if that makes sense. And I think that is very much embedded in the work and in the openness of the work, and the ambiguity. How something can be both and none at once, I think is kind of inherent.
I think that's what I see with the speech bubbles. I think that's why I interpret them as, I can see that as well, because it's like wanting to say something, but words aren't enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, that I love that sculpture as well. That's like the sculpture and then it's its shadow. And you've got the kind of double, like the two together. Mm-hmm. I think the double and the kind of, you know, the double basically as a theme is quite a fascinating one in your work, actually. It's like a subconscious kind of constant running theme that I find really compelling. I also heard you describe queerness before as something incredibly positive and like kind of inclusive and whole,
spiritual,
and kind of a wonderful, rich, positive, fun, great experience, which is such a nice thing to think about. Joy. Do you know what I mean? Like queer joy and trans joy. Unity.
Yeah. I'm like, thank God I'm queer. I don't know. I'm so happy to be queer. I'm so happy to be queer.
Yeah.
It's like being part of a special little club. Yeah. It's fun. Have you ever shown in London?
No, I haven't.
That's crazy.
I've only been to London once. One time. Yeah. And I really liked it. I mean, I got a good hit from it, but.
We need to hit you again. Not like that. Yeah. We need to bring you back to London and hit you again.
London, I know. Once our world loosens up a little bit, I can't wait to... I mean, that's another thing of just the experience for the last year. Like, in a way, I think there's something incredible about not being able to go anywhere. It's almost like being... My girlfriend was like, it's almost like we're in high school, like when you really couldn't go anywhere and you really couldn't do
like
anything.
So like that, yeah.
And... You know, and I'm like, I kind of feel that way where it's like, now I'm like, let's go on a walk to the mountains and then jump in the pool. That'll just be like the most fun thing we've ever done in our entire lives.
Yeah.
And it is. And I'm like, okay, thank you. I'm like, it's kind of like getting back to like these base pleasures and appreciation of like what's actually right here, right now. And there's so, you know, there's such a kind of like, grasping for everything outside of ourselves to make ourselves feel whole in our culture, where it's like actually just go in and you're fine. Just jump in.
Do you think it's made you a bit more spiritual in this time? Because it feels like there's some works in your recent show that feel like there's a grave of a priest that appears, and called Thomas Merton, who became a monk. And there's elements that suddenly feel like there's a spiritual side of you, which we're seeing in this latest body of work.
Well, I started studying Tibetan Buddhism and tantric meditation. Those are separate lineages in the last year more intensively. I always considered myself to be a spiritual person, but I didn't have like a direct discipline that I followed. But I am finding having a daily meditation practice is helping me through this, just to navigate this moment, to navigate the last year and all the forms of loss that I've encountered in the last year. I think I'm kind of trying to imagine how I would be handling everything that's happened if I didn't sit on a daily basis. And I think there's something about sitting that has allowed me to kind of like drop a narrative or drop this like kind of circulating of like an idea of what's happening over and over again, which can ultimately just cause a lot of pain. Whereas like I'm just coming into each moment. There's a lot of grief and loss right now. And I think it's just really important to allow yourself to really feel it and go into it and not try to push it away, but also not try to kind of constantly rehydrate it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of true.
I've also been really, really drawn to your recent paintings of like almost like fossilized skeletons or something. Like my mum worked at the Natural History Museum when I was a kid, so I was constantly going through all the drawers, and you'd used to find like claws of dinosaurs or like maps of what the whole body of the dinosaur would have looked
like. See, archaeological.
Like.
There's an Egyptian in there as well.
But I'm really into
Anubis.
That. Yeah, and that kind of like archaeology and like the timeline. This kind of idea of like ancient, you know, creatures. Or can you speak a bit about that new element that's...
Yeah, I was thinking about like this collapsing of this timeline too, for like, you know, that like that. So I finished a meditation and immediately the word camel skeleton popped in my head. And I was like, okay.
What? The camel skeleton?
camel skeleton. It was like the way that I get these little like clips of language, I do, and I'm like, okay. So it was camel skeleton. And I was like, okay. And then I started to do a search and I found an image of a camel skeleton that had been unearthed in Vienna in 2006 during like the excavation of a, you know, a piece of land in order to build a shopping center. Oh, so people are like digging to build a shopping center and come across a camel skeleton in Vienna. So it's like, what is this camel skeleton doing in Vienna? Camels don't live in Vienna. And as it turned out, it was like an Ottoman war camel from the 16th century. So, and I did feel like this collapsing of timelines in that discovery, and also like how you could be doing something so mundane, like digging to build a mall, and then you find, you know. So I also was just moved by that image. And when I was a kid, I had this book of skeletons that were all superimposed against a black background, and I loved it. It was like a penguin, a horse, a turtle, and it was like, oh, I loved this book. It was, I wish I had it. So yeah, that's also somewhat fed into like just kind of the camel skeleton floating in this,
love,
this abyss. But when
I'm excited to see where this goes. Yeah.
So I started painting the camel, and then we got hit with massive fires to the point where my girlfriend and I were like, okay, we actually just need to leave. Like, we can't. It was like not just burning trees. It was like burning structures and all of the chemicals that are released in that. And we were just like sick. So we drove to New Mexico. So camel skeleton, pause, come back, continue painting the camel skeleton. And I also was like, I don't even know how I'm going to paint this camel skeleton. How the hell am I going to do this? And Emily was like, just one bone at a time, math. So each bone was like its own, like completely its own like container of a moment. But then within the composition of the piece, it was broken up into like kind of like an act in three tragedies, because then a week and a half later, my mother falls deathly ill. We have to go to New York. My mother passes away. Wow, so you know, which, I mean, I'm not even like right now I can be like, and then my mom died. So it's not like that at all. It's been such a huge, huge loss, and just, you know, a real transformation on a cellular level of everything that I kind of feel like I understood. But that, you know, broke the composition up. 3 weeks later, I come back and I'm like, oh my God, I will finish painting this camel skeleton. So then I just kept going. By the time I got to the last toe of the camel, I was like just weeping, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna finish. Wow. And I painted the last toe, and then it was done. So if you look at it, or if you see the painting, you kind of like almost see like it's like it's not even like cohesive. It's like a record of this period of time, and then the way that bones are like a record, that hold a record of a life. And so I think there was that happening with that piece. So a lot of the works from this new show kind of entered in ways that I couldn't have anticipated. Like, I didn't seek out to paint Thomas Merton's grave, but when I was doing some research, Thomas Merton was mentioned in a book I was reading. The book was called How to Do Nothing, and I was reading this book, and I was immediately compelled by him, so I did research on him, and he had written this autobiography called The Seven Story Mountain, which came out in the 50s and was very popular, and had it not been a religious text, it would have been like a bestseller, but I think there was something prohibiting religious texts from being bestsellers. And his writing was so like clear and simple and beautiful. And it started just like this story of how he, I don't know, like his journey into asceticism. And he was born in France and then ended up moving to New York, and actually grew up in what at the time was a pastoral town in Queens, which was next to the town that I grew up in. So I thought it was like very compelling to even imagine the little town that I grew up in, which was like a New York City suburb, being like pastoral and being this, where this guy also grew up. So I was looking, I was doing an image search to see what he looked like, and I came across an image of his grave at an abbey that he's buried in Kentucky. And in every image that I found, it was like his tombstone surrounded by identical tombstones, but his tombstone always was adorned with like rosaries or flowers. And then in one instance, I found an image of it with this white satin sash, and I just found it to be so moving, you know, this really like kind of like emptiness and presence all in one. And like sort of like you see that body there, you see that adornment, and then you also see like just the loss and the absence of the body. And then the head of Anubis, my friend Isabel Albuquerque, who's an artist in LA, one of my really close friends, sent me an image of this head of Anubis, and because I have a little dog that looks kind of like Anubis, she's a black chihuahua with very sharp features, and I was immediately just, her name is Joan, like Joan Didion.
Love. Oh yes, who I saw you post a picture on your Instagram while you were, there was a cigarette on the...
She was holding a cigarette, just an LA icon. But I was really drawn to just the iconic silhouette of this artifact, and then also just thinking about like the flattening and categorization of what was once a really potent spiritual object and is now just sort of being like museologically reached for with the white colonial gloved hand. And so I just wanted to like create a little narrative around that.
Well, I always feel like it relates to the hieroglyphics, which feel like they are kind of part of your language. As you were saying earlier on, the repetition of an old pharaoh, you would lend to highlight it, exclamation mark now. It feels like Anubis is a nod to that kind of language that is relating.
Yeah,
to
I think that was like where the initial attraction, because immediately when I got the image, I just felt such a resonance, and I felt such a connection to the image and in the way that it relates to some, I guess kind of indirectly, but relates to some of the forms that I've worked with.
Well, the Scotty dog is like...
Yes, absolutely, the Scotty dog.
That's one of your motifs. Well, that show is called Desert Veins, which is at Vilmeta in Los Angeles, and that's amazing. So we should move on to the questions that we ask every guest that comes on, the same two questions. Mm-hmm. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, Math, if you could have any work of art in the world to yourself, for yourself, and it's fine, you can have it, what would it be and why?
And we can help you. It can be as big or small as...
Oh, my God. Let me
it can think. Be anything.
Okay. There's this little Villard painting at the Met. It's so small. It's like 10 by 12. And it's a little group of people gathered around a table. And I believe that it's like capturing like post-funerary or some kind of gathering right after a loved one has died. I'm sorry, I'm so morbid, but it is. And it's just really fine and almost like unintelligible strokes become the image. Uh-huh. I can send you a picture. Anyway,
Yeah, we can post it on our Instagram. So who painted it?
Villard. V-U-I-L-L-A-R-D. I can't pronounce anything.
Yeah, great. Okay, cool. And the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color? Which I am intrigued.
Yellow.
Because...
Yellow.
Really? Yellow.
Yay.
Yellow is my favorite color. I love yellow. I love yellow.
Yellow's not morbid, so it's the opposite. No.
I love yellow is the color of the bedroom I grew up in. I love yellow. I love the way yellow feels. All shades of yellow, especially bright, bright yellow.
That's what I've got. I've got the arches in yellow that you
painted. I know. I love those arches.
I love that. I mean, you've got like, I think I don't really see it in any other works, but you have like this kind of black sky, just a section that goes across the top. Mm-hmm. What was the language going through that piece particularly?
With the arches and the black sky?
Yeah.
I feel like it was this way of like, I'm trying to remember exactly because it really like worked with that painting, I feel. It like created a weight. It created a container. I think it like kind of compositionally like, it was sort of like what takes up space and what also is spaceless at the same time. I really liked about it.
I love that. And is Ellsworth Kelly like a hero of yours, and Carmen Herrera, like the big geometric abstractionist?
I mean both. Yeah, I love both of those.
Because when you said yellow, there's actually one of my favorite paintings ever is a yellow shape by Ellsworth Kelly, which I think
it's
weirdly
like a bee, isn't
it? Mm-hmm. I think he told me once at Freeze New York, maybe even the same year you had your solo booth. Weirdly, he came on the booth and said he just bought this yellow Ellsworth Kelly, and it's the most beautiful.
It's in Architectural Digest. It's
like, and I love how those paintings, some of them are just like object and that like kind of intersection between object and painting.
Yeah.
Really beautiful.
Before we go, Math, what advice would you give to like a young artist or an emerging artist or even an artist that might have been doing it for a long time and hasn't, you know, even got to show yet? Because you're someone that's obviously, you know, part of the kind of commercial art world in a way, and you're being written about and you're showing in museums as well as private galleries. Like, what advice would you give an artist?
I always say there's nothing more valuable than forming your community of peers and really engaging with your peer group and finding spaces, unexpected spaces to show your work, house performances, put up your art shows, just like use what you have. And really, like, there's nothing more important, I think, than like having a community of artists.
Agreed.
That you're in dialogue with. I think that really gets you through.
Oh, I'd love to know some of the people who's in your kind of crew. Who's your squad?
Who's my squad? Are you familiar with Alex Chavez, Chavez?
Yes. I know Alex from LA.
You do?
He helped us install our booth at Los Angeles years and years and years ago, maybe like 8 years ago.
Years and years ago, that makes sense.
Yeah, and
he
he's
is one of my favorite.
He's amazing.
Favorite painters. I love him so much. I love his work. I think he's just brilliant, just kind of... Yeah, it's Alex Eve Fowler.
Oh yeah,
incredible.
Yeah,
incredible artist, incredible facilitator, incredible curator, just across the board. You know, she just does it all, and she's brilliant. My friend Amy Robertson, one of my other favorite artists. Who else are some of my peeps? My partner Emily Siegel, who is an artist and a novelist.
I love her.
Who else are some of my favorite artists in LA? Sarah Clendenning, I would say, kind of somehow a lesser known but brilliant sculptor. Who are some other people that I love? I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, who have I seen in the last...
No one.
I know. Like, I'm like, Marissa Tikal. Lauren Halsey.
I love Lauren's work.
Brilliant. So inspired, like just incredible work. Who else is really that
Ross,
I'm really
we still have to go to LA,
LA
and do a whole like talk art series.
Come to LA, do a crawl once our
Honestly, I think LA it's the best studio visits of my life. Like because you
Isabel Albuquerque.
Oh yes. Right.
So good. Ada's daughter.
Amazing. Well, Math, this has been phenomenal.
Love you so
thank you
much.
so much for speaking
so nice
to us from your high rise on Los Feliz.
Yeah.
You have a beautiful mind.
With the raids going on around you.
I love the
you.
Way you think about it. It's a beautiful way of looking at the world. I love it. I have so much respect for you.
Yeah.
And thank you for your generosity and being so open. And it's very inspiring.
Totally.
Thanks for inviting me on. This was lovely.
Of course. Cool. For everyone listening, we are on Talk Art on Instagram and Twitter. And are you active on Instagram, Math?
In and out.
You are on there, though.
I go off.
It's at.
I'm on there.
Yeah,
I'm on
at
there.
Math Pearl Bass.
I am on there.
Yeah.
I'm on there.
At Math.
For my sanity. I'm too compulsive. You know what I mean? I'm too compulsive. I can't. If I keep it on, I can't modulate. I just can't.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so amazing. Much. For images of all the artworks we've discussed in today's episode, you can visit our Instagram at TalkArt, and you can visit Math's Instagram, which is at MathPearlBass. And you can also visit Tanya Layton's gallery.
And Vilmeta.
And we'll be posting links. But thank you so much, and we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Math.
Bye, Math.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to TalkArt with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to TalkArt at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.